Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disadvantages and disabilities who have had taken from them or have been denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them. In a few moments, Disrespect will introduce you to Tina Tidmore of Pandora, a U.S. organization based in Florida that supports people with CFS and ME. For now, we'll bring you Under the Hammer, our semi-regular weekly feature of people in trouble who have disabilities or disadvantages. This is the woman we've been talking about before, who has an apartment full of toxins from mice. Apparently on her floor there are two or three apartments now infected by bedbugs, and she's beginning to wonder if the bedbugs are coming for her. Her landlord hasn't shown any initiative in addressing this problem, just as they haven't shown much initiative in addressing the problem of mouse toxins. The whole building's full of people with disabilities, and under the Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act is public housing. Anyone who stepped in and pointed out to these tenants that they could each receive $100,000 a day for the time that they're inconvenienced and their dignity is compromised by this landlord would run up quite a substantial fine for the landlord, and it wouldn't be negotiable or appealable, apparently, under the law. The same judge would hear the appeal as hear the original case. So the landlord may not know it, but if they feel a shadow creeping up behind them, they are under the hammer. Originally, our interview was meant for May the 12th, ME Day, Florence Nightingale's birthday, but it took a long string of connections and referrals to get to Tina. She's with us now. She's going to talk to us about why it would be nice if these people were able to pay taxes, but what are the barriers that prevent them from getting research and medical support and support on fixed incomes, such as Dalton McGuinty and the special diet, to get over their illness. Tina Tidmore. Tina, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
There's been new support in British Columbia with the establishment of an organization dedicated to researching myalgic encephalomyelitis and chronic fatigue syndrome. And you tell me there's been new advocacy efforts as well. What about those?
Well, yes. Using the internet, there's been a flurry of activity as new research has come out in the last 2 years, and it's energized the community. They realize that they now have some research that may make others more interested in their illness. So email campaigns, advertisements, even demonstrations on both sides of the Atlantic, patients are getting the word out to the public about ME-CFS now, and that has created much more interest and awareness about the nature of the illness and the research that has shown that it is a biological illness.
As opposed to
the vagueness and blaming the patients, which is something that was done in the past.
Okay.
And now the immune system abnormalities, the brain abnormalities, endocrine system abnormalities, not to mention bringing back the understanding that this illness occurred in outbreaks all over the world.
Right.
And so that, bringing that back into the public's awareness, has increased people's understanding that this is a physiological illness that is severely disabling for many people.
Yeah, so it's not a mental illness, for example, or a figment of people's imagination, such as something which is psychosomatic. Not to disparage psychosomatic illness either, which feels very real, but it is used to disparage chronic fatigue syndrome and NME?
Well, certainly 4,000 research papers at least have shown these biological abnormalities.
Right.
And, yeah, those days are really in the past now, and maybe the public was not aware of that. Maybe many physicians are not aware of that.
Right.
But the research really has gone on almost under the radar until a couple of years ago. And now it's really gotten out into the public, the true nature of this illness.
Sounds like there's been a change in the nature of the research. Is that something you can share with us?
Well, in the last couple of years, there has been some breakthroughs that have brought back some of the thoughts that those physicians that were in the areas of the outbreaks, at least in the United States, in the mid-1980s, where many of those physicians said it looked like it was a retrovirus. And so some researchers went also, took a look back at that and said, you know, it does look like a retrovirus. So there has been some research into that, a breakthrough study in October of 2009 that came from three institutions, Whittemore Peterson Institute out of Reno, Nevada, the National Cancer Institute, which is part of the U.S. government research institutes, and then there's the Cleveland Clinic, also of the United States.
What's the name of the Cleveland Clinic, right?
Cleveland Clinic, right. And they announced that they found a retrovirus that is a distant cousin to HIV in 67% of ME/CFS patients. Now, since then, many studies have come out that said they don't see.
This is XMRV, right?
That's what it's called.
Yeah.
XMRV, which stands for xenotropic murine leukemia virus-like virus. The xenotropic means in other species, murine means mouse. So it's something that had been in mice and now is in other species.
Okay.
And this is similar to that virus. So it's the xenotropic murine leukemia virus-like virus.
Okay.
So, yeah, so many retrovirologists became very interested in that. Other studies came out that said, we looked in our patient population, we don't find it, but many of them were using different methods to test. There's problems in identifying who really has the core original illness. What I'm saying is that different diagnostic criteria, how to define them.
Oh, yes.
And with the different diagnostic criteria, you may be capturing people in your studies that have something else.
Okay.
That may look like it but not truly be ME/CFS.
All right.
So then we did have, from the United States, the National Institutes of Health and FDA that came out with a study where they found retroviruses of that same family, not exactly the same, but of the same family, in 87% of the ME/CFS patients that tested. Then they found it also in 7% of the blood donors they tested.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So then there became a group that was established in the United States called the Blood Working Group.
Right.
And they were looking particularly at the possibility of this retrovirus being spread through the blood and possibly that it would be causing or have influence over whether someone develops the disease. One of the things that people in other countries noticed is that Canada really took the lead in protecting the public when they announced that ME/CFS patients would no longer be donating blood in April of 2010.
Is Canada unique that way?
No, afterwards some other countries followed, and even in the United States, the Red Cross has also said that they will be deferring ME/CFS patients from donating blood.
Right.
However, the United States FDA had a committee meeting on it, and the recommendation from that committee was to defer ME/CFS patients. But the FDA has not yet come out with a decision to do so.
So it's not universal in the States yet?
No. If you go to an American Red Cross blood donor center, then you would have information there that tells you that you should not be donating blood if you have ME/CFS. However, that is not consistent in all blood donation clinics. However, one of the things that's interesting about this illness is that in the FDA, the question is asked, do you feel well today before you donate blood?
All right.
But what many people don't know about ME/CFS is that it has good days and bad days.
Mm-hmm.
So unless that illness is included, then you're not capturing the people, or you're not, you know, eliminating those donors, because a person with ME/CFS may feel good and then go to a blood donation center in the morning.
Yeah.
And then later that afternoon they have a crash, and it may last days. Really, no matter whether the XMRV research holds up, and there has been some controversy as recent as last week on this, but whether it holds up or not, many clinicians who specialize in ME/CFS said, because we've seen this in outbreaks and because we know it's not good for the patient, we recommend that they don't donate blood. And many patient organizations also make that recommendation.
Good to know. We know that you've just stated that ME patients have good days and bad days. How can this illness be explained to someone who has no knowledge of it? I mean, let me tell you, I have ME. Let me tell you how I've explained it to someone who's found out that I have a disability and naturally enough to ask what it is, because when they see me, I look fine. The first thing I tell people is that, well, you don't see me on a bad day. On bad days, I'm not generally much out and about more than a block from the house. And there was a time when a block from the house was an achievement for me. You see me on my good days. And I have a lot more good days now than bad days, but that doesn't mean they're not slow getting started. I've noted the immune abnormalities. I've noted balance problems. I've noted short-term memory and working memory, cognitive problems. I used to be the kind of guy who would solve problems in his head. Complicated math problem, two variables, no problem. Just work it out in your head. Not anymore.
Right.
And those are symptoms that I experience. What are the symptoms that ME patients experience in general that they have in common?
Well, what's called the hallmark symptom is post-exertional malaise.
All right.
And that is where the person exerts themselves, and then they have the increase of flu-like symptoms that come on them as a result of that exertion. And that post-exertional malaise can last for days or a week.
All right.
And it can have a delayed effect. You may exert yourself and it's not until the next day, or even as much as 48 hours, that you will feel that payback.
Yeah.
And so that is now more and more being considered a hallmark symptom, because not only do we have patients reporting this symptom, we now have some biological evidence in the body of what happens, that where you can objectively measure that. What is happening is you can bring somebody in with ME/CFS and some healthy people and have them do some exercise.
Right.
Then bring them in the next day, and you will see differences in the way that their genes are activated.
Really?
You will see differences in the way that the ME/CFS patients absorb oxygen. You will see differences in the way that their heart rates respond to the exercise.
Wow.
So this is now research that has come out again just in the last year or two that has made it so that we're thinking we're getting to what's called biomarkers, something where you can actually measure it.
Yeah.
It's kind of fascinating to think that you could actually measure medical fatigue, or you could actually measure pain. It could have implications for many other illnesses.
That's true.
But so that is the hallmark.
It's particularly exciting for people with chronic fatigue or ME, because so long they've lived with the stigma that
It's all in your head. It's not real. Even doctors can't tell if it's real.
Well, that's not the case anymore if you have a knowledgeable physician.
Yeah.
For our Chronic Fatigue show, we'll introduce something a little slower than usual. Nevertheless, blues, Guy Blanger. This is called Coyote. You've been listening to Tina Tidmore of Pandora, a U.S. organization and based in Florida that supports people with CFS and ME. She's going to talk to us about why it would be nice if these people were able to pay taxes, but what are the barriers that prevent them from getting research and medical support and support on fixed incomes, such as Dalton McGuinty and the special diet, to get over their illness.
Of course, as you mentioned, there's the neurological symptoms. Because of the name of the illness, many people don't know that these neurological symptoms are often what makes somebody have to go on disability.
Yeah.
It can include confusion, slowed information processing, that is, you can't absorb information into your brain.
Right.
you can't retrieve words at times.
Yeah.
Mathematics, as you said, that is something that is a common problem. But what's also interesting is that people have little blips. I'll just give you an example. One person told me that they were disabled and they had a caregiver. Someone brought them a plate of food. Within a few minutes, they couldn't find the plate of food.
I have this experience often. It's supposed to be for seniors only, but believe me, if you have ME, you don't have to be a senior.
Right.
It's one of those where you walk into the room and you say, why did I come in here?
Right. And in this case, she found her plate of food in the bathtub. Had no memory of how it got there.
Right.
Putting your wallet in the freezer.
Yeah.
Things like that.
Walking out of the kitchen with a pot on the boil.
Those kind of things are very common. Even some, they can't remember how to turn on their computer.
I'm sorry. That's not funny. Oh, dear.
Well, it can be very disabling, especially for someone who, say, is a professor.
I'm sure.
Someone who is accustomed to being very sharp.
Yeah.
And then suddenly they're doing these things, and as you said, it can even be somewhat dangerous. So these things are not commonly known, and it varies from patient to patient, and it can be manifested in different ways. But these cognitive problems are also not only part of the illness, but it can be the thing that disables them.
Yes.
As much as the fatigue.
Yeah.
And other symptoms that come with this is pain, joint pain, aching, unusual headaches, and some of these symptoms really do make it clear that we are talking about something physical. Tender lymph nodes is a part of it. Sore throats.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that flu feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other symptoms the CDC includes in their list, which is...
The Centers for Disease Control.
That's the Centers for Disease Control.
And they're in Atlanta, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
All right.
They are considered the government agency that is supposed to inspect infectious diseases.
All right.
And however, what's interesting is that their diagnostic criteria is considered to be too broad compared to what we call the Canadian consensus criteria.
Oh, really?
Yes. The Canadians, again, took the lead in this in developing a more narrow diagnostic criteria for this illness, one that is now being referred to in research papers.
Okay.
They will say, yes, these patients met the Canadian consensus criteria or other criteria as well.
Okay.
So with those, you have endocrine symptoms. So you might have, night sweats.
Okay.
You're going to have low hormone symptoms, dizziness. You're going to have even intestinal weight loss is common. Immune system.
Yeah.
Again, the sore throat. Things like that. Morning stiffness, weight loss, which of course is very concerning for some people. But again, not everybody's going to have every one.
And not everybody's going to have them consistently either. I mean, you might have
them
now, and you might not have them a year from now.
We have good days and bad days, but you have mild cases, medium cases, and severe cases.
Right.
You might think of like multiple sclerosis.
Yeah, that's true.
It has many characteristics like multiple sclerosis.
Yeah.
And they both are neuroimmune diseases.
Is it degenerative? It doesn't seem to be properly managed.
Well, we have not had any long-term studies that have shown either way.
Right.
There's just not been the studies to say that. So all we have at this point are, anecdotes.
All right.
What people report.
Right.
And we do see that there are many patients report that it seems to go through stages at least. Now, a few do get better and recover.
Right.
So it would not always be progressive, but for some it does. And it also can be fatal.
Really?
We have seen that too, yes.
In what way?
Well, there was a case of a woman in the UK whose symptoms became so severe and her lack of medical care became so severe that she did die in her 30s. And her, on the autopsy, it said renal failure as a complication of chronic fatigue syndrome. We All have right. had a case here in the United States of a boy who was 9 years old
right.
when he was diagnosed. And that's another thing that people should know, is that children can get this as well.
All right.
So he was 9. His mother already had the illness. He comes down with it. At age 23, he goes to bed one night, and he dies.
Are you serious?
Yes.
And do they know why? Do they know what failed?
An autopsy was done, and it was ruled myocarditis, which is damage to the heart.
Right.
Most likely from a long-term infection.
Right.
And chronic infections is a part of ME/CFS.
Yeah.
Of course, he had been diagnosed with ME/CFS much earlier. At times, we have people with our illness that die an early death, and an autopsy is done, and the results are on the autopsy are undetermined.
Right.
So, yes, it can and occasionally is fatal. We do, as patients, want to see studies that see whether these patients go on to develop cancers, a greater increase
right.
than healthy people, as well as heart problems.
Right.
We do see that many do develop heart problems. We would like to see if this is statistically greater than the population at
and
large.
That study
has. So that's the kind of research we need.
It hasn't yet been done.
Well, when.
That's frightening.
Yes. It is. And that's one of the things that happened in the last month with ME/CFS Awareness Month, is that there was a committee in Washington, D.C. that met. And that's one of the things some of the patients asked for,
okay.
is to trace what happens to the patients. We now have patients that were there at the outbreaks that occurred in the 1980s, including there was an outbreak in Canada.
Where was the outbreak in Canada?
The outbreak in Canada was over 500 cases during August to November of 1984, and this was in the Montreal, Quebec, Ontario area.
Okay. That's a big area.
Yes. And this then continued, and of course we know many others that are getting the illness now all over. But that is one case where you had 500 cases in that short period of time, August to November of 1984.
I left Ontario in 1980 for Vancouver, and I wasn't there 2 or 3 years before I started coming down with symptoms.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, it seems like the mid-80s was a big time for outbreaks. There were 2 outbreaks in the United States, one in Lindenville, a rural town about between 800 and 900 people in New York, and then there was one in Incline Village, Nevada.
Right.
Which is the most widely known one in the United States. But before that, even as back as 1934 in the United States, there were outbreaks, and in that case...
34?
1934, yes. That was in a hospital in Los Angeles, and that was an illness that has the symptoms that we now recognize as ME/CFS.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And it's happened in other countries as well. The ME, myalgic encephalomyelitis, name came from the UK after an outbreak at a hospital called the Royal Free Hospital.
Okay.
That happened in the 1950s.
50s.
Yes. The patients really never did get a good understanding of what caused these outbreaks.
So strikes me is that the data is out there. Some of these patients are now in their 80s or 90s if they're still alive. And so we the data is out there about what happens to these patients. We just haven't been collecting it.
Yes, and there has been good research.
Yeah.
The trouble is getting that research to be with a large enough group of patients that it then would be taught in medical schools, and then we would have the physicians in general, not just those that happen to have a lot of patients with it, but physicians in general that know about this research that has happened.
Right.
Many studies have been validated with follow-up studies, but the money just hasn't been there.
No.
However, that's why, as you mentioned in the beginning, it's really wonderful to see Canada take the lead with this new study and center that's going to be in British Columbia.
We've all heard about it, but I haven't heard any names connected with it, so I haven't been able to go further and find out.
Well, we do know that it's going to be looking at the multiple illnesses, ME/CFS, Lyme disease, and fibromyalgia.
Right.
And they're
all of which are symptomatically
complex
close.
Chronic diseases.
Yeah.
And the press release on this said that these illnesses are strongly indicated as having an infectious agent playing a role.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what they're going to be looking at there. This announcement came in March because in that press release it said that among Canadians with 23 chronic conditions, those with chronic fatigue syndrome consistently ranked as having more unmet medical home care, less food security, more marginalization, and more need of help with tasks than the other illnesses.
Hamilton is unique among Canadian cities in providing help for people with disabilities and tasks. Every community has access to the provincial government, but no other community has access to a municipal program. And I approached the municipal program, and a worker came to the door, and I opened the door, and she took one look at me, and she said, "Well, you don't have a disability," and she turned around and walked away. As a result, the place has been a horror ever since.
Well, it's very difficult for us to understand why would that treatment be given to someone who has multiple sclerosis, lupus?
Mm-hmm.
Many of these are invisible conditions and yet can be very disabling.
Do we know where this center in BC is going to be located yet?
I have not seen any information on that particularly. But they started off with a study. Already $2 million has been put towards a study to help with diagnosis and treatment.
When does that wrap up, do you know?
No, I don't know. This was just announced in March, so we're in the early parts of it.
You know, it's another symptom of this illness that we're getting this information from you in Alabama, and we're here in Canada. It's not that it wasn't in the news here, but we don't have any more information than you do.
Mm-hmm. Well, no doubt information will be coming out soon.
No doubt.
In the United States, we just had a State of the Knowledge conference that was hosted by the National Institutes of Health. And one of the presenters there said to the National Institutes of Health that if you will not lead in setting up centers that can care for people with these neuroendocrine immune diseases, will you follow? And then told about that center that's being established in British Columbia. Can other countries do this? So that we don't have these underserved patients that end up going from doctor to doctor to doctor to doctor that are rejected for disability when they certainly qualify. It sometimes even happens to go to court to establish that.
Yeah.
These are the things that if we had these centers and had knowledgeable physicians where the research that we know of is getting to the physicians and then influencing the care, then it would be a big leap forward, and having these kind of centers like what British Columbia is doing would be a great model to happen in multiple countries all over the world.
Yeah, research in chronic fatigue is rapidly updated, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Just very.
So you need a doctor who's willing to stay up to date with research and medication.
And so we look forward to more studies, although there's been so much controversy over this XMRV, with science journals and other researchers saying, no, we've determined it's the contamination. Other researchers are saying, no, we've got huge studies that are going to be coming out. The research needs to continue until those play out. So from patients, we just want good, solid, large-scale clinical trials, solid research that has blinded samples. Just move it forward. It's so many people. There are 330,000 Canadians that have chronic fatigue syndrome and 1 million Americans. So
it seems disproportionate in Canada then, right? I mean, there should be one-tenth as many Canadians as Americans, but there's one-third as many.
I wouldn't know about that.
Our population,
this is according to the Statistics Canada.
Our population tracks the U.S.
About one-tenth.
So
yeah.
The incidence...
Well, that goes again to how you diagnose it.
Doesn't it? Yeah.
Yes. But according to Statistics Canada, over 330,000 Canadians have chronic fatigue syndrome.
My goodness.
And that survey was conducted in 2003 and was released in mid-2005.
All right. So there are more.
The Centers for Disease Control came up with their own diagnostic criteria, and they formed the name chronic fatigue syndrome, which many patients believe is not an accurate reflection of the illness.
Or respectful of the people who are ill.
Or respectful of it, right, and can be minimalized when compared to the actual level of disability that it causes, and can give some misconceptions and doesn't take into consideration the other symptoms. When that name was formed and the diagnostic criteria from the CDC, then many clinicians started diagnosing it. And so therefore, there has not been any records of whether it's occurring at higher rates in certain areas compared to others.
All right.
That would only be something that a local physician would notice. So since then, no, but that is something that many patients are urging, that it needs to be a reportable illness so that we can still track the illness as it may be occurring worldwide, but also if it may occur, for example, in a hospital in a higher rate at a certain time, or has it become endemic where it's just now it's worldwide, and if you have the right other factors, then you get the illness. Those are things that are not known, and
right.
So there's more research done in this.
Is ME taken hold as a name in the States, too?
It is beginning to. The National Institutes of Health is now using the combo ME/CFS.
Very good.
That the outbreaks of this illness that occurred in the UK, where it received the ME name, is the same symptoms as the illness of the outbreaks in the United States.
And the name, while not technically accurate without the research behind it, is nevertheless less disrespectful.
Yes, many patients really do prefer to call it ME. Even in the United States, many patients do. So it's good that some government officials are now recognizing the seriousness of the illness and some of the effects that it does have on the brain.
Mm-hmm.
So,
that's still hard to get well-received, I think, that it's neurological. I think a lot of people just associate it with being tired. And I had to tell a receptionist at one doctor's office, she says, so you have chronic fatigue. I said, well, no, actually. I said, chronic fatigue is what affects single mothers. I said, I have chronic fatigue syndrome. She says, well, you can explain that to the doctor. I said, hey, goodbye. And we left the clinic.
Another name some researchers prefer is myalgic encephalopathy.
Yes, that's what I've heard is the more recent preferred moniker for the illness.
Yes, some researchers prefer that. So one doctor wrote a book, it's a disease of 1,000 names. But one patient who talks to another patient will recognize, you have my illness. It only takes a 5 minutes to exchange stories. Also, of course, physicians who see many patients will see the pattern and say, you know, you have this illness, so or whatever name you call it, it's a serious neurological, immune system, and endocrine system disease or dysfunction between those.
All right.
and on the need for more research and more support. Archie Gillis, a subject dear to the hearts of people with chronic fatigue, priorities.
A new dawn, the rising of this day, infinite possibilities, at least some would say. A coffee in the morning gets me up from where I lay. Here's my list of things to do to finish for today. I'll paint the world a masterpiece, discover a cure for all disease, I'll compose a great symphony, save the world from ecological catastrophe, or instead I'll spend all day staring at the sun. Close one eye, try to catch the light between my finger and my thumb. I'll look up at the sky and wonder why it's blue. Sometimes doing nothing's my favorite thing to do. Now I could delegate these tasks if I were a king, but nothing done by force really means anything. And now I must prioritize the importance of these things. What will be first, what will be last, or what will this day bring? First I'll paint the world a masterpiece and discover a cure for all disease. I'll compose a symphony and save the world from ecological catastrophe. Or instead, I'll spend all day staring at the sun. Close one eye, try to catch the light between my finger and my thumb. I'll look up at the sky and wonder why it's blue. Sometimes doing nothing's my favorite thing to do. I'll spend all day staring at the sun. Close one eye, try to catch the light between my finger and my thumb. I look up at the sky and wonder why it's blue. Sometimes doing nothing's my favorite thing to do. Sometimes doing nothing's the most important thing to do.
You've been listening to Tina Tidmore of Pandora, a U.S. organization and based in Florida that supports people with CFS and ME. She's going to talk to us about why it would be nice if these people were able to pay taxes, but what are the barriers that prevent them from getting research and medical support and support on fixed incomes, such as Dalton McGuinty and the special diet, to get over their illness.
ME-CFS patients tend to burn through nutrients at a much higher rate.
Why is that?
Well, that's something we need more research on.
Right.
That's one of the things. We need to have large-scale studies that look at why these things are occurring in the body, and that's where why the patients are doing this advocacy in order to bring attention to the need for more research funding. But there are some things that we see the effects of, and it just needs to be traced back to see where the cause comes from or how things relate to one another,
right.
The systems and the biological functions, to see if this is abnormal, then what could cause that. But we do see that the patients burn through the nutrients. There's some studies that show there's some mitochondrial dysfunction going on. So therefore, a patient is often advised by physicians to eat high-nutrient foods, green leafy vegetables, protein, things like that.
All the things you can't afford on a fixed income, right?
Yeah, high-nutrient foods. Also, people with ME/CFS tend to have low blood volume.
Mm-hmm.
So they are encouraged to drink lots of water.
And also again, we don't have an understanding of why low blood volume would accompany CFS.
There's a couple of theories on that. The ME/CFS is an autonomic nervous system is altered, and that's the center that controls many of these automatically controlled things you don't consciously think of, things like blood pressure, blood volume. And so there's questions concerning whether maybe the control center is a little bit off.
All right.
So that's just one theory.
All right.
So increased intake of water is another suggestion that also can help flush out toxins, mm-hmm. which some ME/CFS patients, their bodies are not as efficient at eliminating toxins. Also, many ME/CFS patients, although not all, have low blood pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a few have high blood pressure,
right.
but a great many have low blood pressure. So, interestingly, these people may receive a recommendation from their physician to eat more salt.
Right.
There are also, of course, some things that ME/CFS patients are often told to avoid.
Have we ever observed... And I don't know the answer to this, and I'm just asking you in case you've come across one. Have we ever observed that ME/CFS patients are slow to adapt their blood pressure to changing circumstances, that in fact a relaxed or reclining ME/CFS patient is likely to fall over when they stand up?
Absolutely. That is one of the, there are studies that have shown that. The condition is called orthostatic intolerance. Another name for that or something similar would be called neurally mediated hypotension. And then some have a heart rate dysfunction that goes with it, and that's called postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. Don't want to just throw out all these names, but that's been shortened to POTS, P-O-T-S. So yes, blood pressure control as far as changing the positions. They have a test called a tilt table test.
Yeah.
Where they put you on it, and then they rotate you from lying down or a sideways position up to an upright position, and they measure your heart rate and your blood pressure, and often they can see suddenly it drops.
Okay.
And it can be as much as 15 minutes later being brought up, or it can be soon after, right after. So, yes, the blood pressure control is off,
right.
And that's why... Some physicians, when they see that in the ME/CFS patients, will recommend an increase in salt.
Right. Yeah, well, I had a naturopath recommend rhodiola. Unfortunately, on my budget, I've had to give up the rhodiola, and with it, a lot of my balance. And I'm a little annoyed at the Premier of Ontario for having imposed this on me.
So then there's some things that need to be avoided as well.
Yeah?
Yes, many ME/CFS patients report alcohol intolerance.
Oh, yeah.
The toxins and the effects of alcohol are exaggerated in many ME/CFS patients.
All right.
Another thing that really is of great concern is caffeine.
Right.
And one of the reasons that this is that caffeine comes up often is because when you have that feeling of lack of energy, your battery feels like it's dead, then naturally many people go and get a cold drink, a soda with caffeine in it. And so when a person does not know, they may be reaching for caffeinated drinks to try to perk them back up.
Right.
But that has a problem in the central nervous system.
Well,
it
that?
Exacerbates the problems that ME/CFS patients have in their central nervous system.
How does it
so
do that?
So many patients are advised to avoid caffeine.
How does it do that? How does it make the problems worse?
Well, it's a stimulant.
It's what?
And in ME/CFS patients, their central nervous system seems to be more hyperactive in the fight or flight mode.
Okay.
So anything that encourages that is not only going to have an effect on that person while they're awake, but insomnia is also a problem with any CFS patients.
All right. Yeah.
So therefore, the caffeine can have a greater effect on the patient's ability to go into the sleep and digest and rest mode of the central nervous system, the calm, relaxed mode of the central nervous system.
Oh, I see. Okay. So it tends to be a swing from a depressed central nervous system to an overactive one, and no place in between if you rely on cola and coffee.
Well, even in sleep, some studies have shown that while the patients are sleeping, they're not getting as much of the stage 3, stage 4 deep sleep.
Right.
Because the central nervous system is bringing them back up to stage 1 or stage 2.
Yeah.
So, therefore, that's a strong reason why caffeine should be avoided, as many physicians do suggest. Of course, anybody with this illness, everybody's going to be slightly different, and they should get some advice from their own physician on their particular symptoms and biological abnormalities.
Yeah.
I'm just reporting what many physicians who specialize in the illness have seen is beneficial, or what makes sense according to what these physicians have see is going on in multiple patients.
We
also have some supplements that many physicians will recommend for their patients.
Yeah, you mentioned magnesium, ubiquinol.
Yes, ubiquinol, that's CoQ10 ubiquinol.
Right.
It's really good antioxidant. It helps with cellular energy.
Okay.
Ubiquinol version is reported to be better with absorption. Again, a multivitamin is important to get those nutrients that the cells are burning up.
Mm-hmm.
A good B complex vitamin, some even recommend a sublingual
B12.
Yeah. The omega-3s and unsaturated 6 that help with the cellular membrane,
right,
so that functions better. There's also many ME/CFS patients may end up with a vitamin D deficiency.
Why is that?
So, well, there's could be the dysfunction or the depletion of nutrients,
right,
but also there's a possibility of not as much sun exposure.
Yeah, that's true. If you're staying on your back all the time, you're
right,
not getting a lot
so
of sun.
So that is something that if a person is tested and they are found to be vitamin D deficient, that is recommended. A person should be tested for these things to see if that fits their case.
All right. Well, it's interesting to hear these from you, especially the mention of protein and leafy green vegetables. I know the alteration to the immune system that takes place with ME/CFS makes carbohydrates a last choice food for a lot of sufferers of ME and CFS. But on a low cost diet, it's kind of hard to avoid the carbohydrates, and it's very hard to afford the protein and the green leafy vegetables that you would normally want with this illness.
For some, that's the case.
Yeah.
And for the financial hardships that come on someone who has lost their ability to work and the difficulties in getting disability benefits, for many puts them in a position where they're having to make some difficult choices.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that is a great challenge. It's part of the budget that they have to consider, is how to get the most out of their food. And also many supplements, if they've become sick, now they've got the extra financial burden of all these supplements that are being recommended for their illness.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So as you said, with the immune system, that can cause a yeast, what's called candida, to flourish, as you might think of with somebody who's been on chemotherapy.
All right.
And that yeast can become much more active, and so some physicians who find that in ME/CFS patients will recommend what's called the anti-candida diet, which would be elimination of sugars and cutting back on some of those simple carbohydrates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the staples of a fixed-income diet. Well, I really appreciate your time.
Okay.
I would gather that your concluding point, having spoken to you about this, would be that there is more research needed.
Yes, that is the message that's being spread now internationally. Many organizations internationally are saying there needs to be more biomedical research into this illness on the level that compares to what other illnesses get.
Yeah. And you mentioned that a new research facility has been budgeted for in British Columbia and Canada, but that's the only one so far.
That is a new one for
yeah.
British Columbia. There are some centers that, you know, do treat it, but this one is specialized. It's going to be looking at the other illnesses that are similar or are also seen in ME/CFS patients. That's fibromyalgia and chronic Lyme disease. So, yes, that center just announced in March is going to include studies in these illnesses as well as care. See, that's one of the things is that it's important to have research that is in the same place where the patients are getting care.
All right.
Yeah, so that then one informs the other.
Yeah.
And a physician is going to see the pattern seen in the patients. And also when the research is done right there, well, there you have your patients that you can use in your research right there in the same center.
Yeah, that's
true. So this
true.
Is a new trend. They call them centers of excellence.
Oh, okay. Hadn't heard that term in a medical context before. But I guess the advice given in the last couple of centuries ago by a publisher, Go West Young Man, would probably be worth considering for somebody in Canada with ME. Yeah. I thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
All right.
Okay.
Tina.
And to take us out, Guy Belanger, That Train. If you can't access a Disrespect broadcast, you can now listen to the show wherever you're near an internet download. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at showtime to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.